sort of moved to one of KBOO's commitments is serving the underserved. So if somebody else is serving a market, then, you know, KBOO moves off. So that's a big change. Interestingly enough, I became station manager as a result of a lot of turmoil at the station, which is somewhat similar to how I just came on the board. I was a more or less active volunteer from the late 60s until the mid 80s, and then I went away for 20 years. And people who are KBOO aficionados know of the dark times of 2 years ago, and I came back involved in KBOO because it seemed to be endangered. So that kind of happened.
Well, we are, unfortunately, to the second, almost out of time. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. We've got a ton of things that we'd still like to ask you about, so hopefully we can get you back here for a future edition of News from the VOO. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Occupy Radio. First, a few things we think you ought to know.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month is the amazing Nina Simone, showing Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. Nina Simone was one of America's true musical geniuses. With her unique signature mix of layering folk, gospel, classical, pop, and African music, along with a revolutionary vision of Black freedom, pride, and defiance. Again, that's the amazing and revolutionary Miss Nina Simone, showing as part of the We Real Cool film series on Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Joe Hill Centennial Tribute Concert Thursday, November 19th, 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. Joe Hill was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World and wrote the classic labor songs There Is Power in a Union, The Rebel Girl, and many more. Joe Hill was executed by the state of Utah 100 years ago and will be remembered with a concert featuring Anne Finney, Citizen Band, and General Strike. Again, that's the Joe Hill Centennial Tribute Thursday, November 19th at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The news and opinions expressed on Occupy Radio may not necessarily reflect the views of KWVA Eugene, the University of Oregon, or the Associated Students of the University of Oregon.
From the Pacifica Network, this is Occupy Radio, covering stories of resilience and resistance, integrating activism into our everyday lives.
You have to understand that people are on their own. And in moving through this process, you know, the end game is structural change. And if structural change can't be obtained in the courts, then it means that we move to something else, which is, in many of these states, they have citizen initiative processes to amend their own state constitutions. And then eventually the state work has to propel itself up to the federal. But, you know, make no mistake about it, the community rights movement is about seizing our own governments and turning them upwards against this corporate and governmental beast.
Across the United States, local communities are realizing practices like fracking and mountaintop removal are dangerous, poisonous, hard on water supplies, and bad for local economies. At the same time, those same communities are finding they have no legal means to address these issues. Thomas Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund joins Occupy Radio we discuss the National Community Rights Network forming to protect our environment at the local government level.
Welcome to all of our listeners near and far, all across the U.S. and even beyond these borders. I'm Rivera Sun. I'm your host of Occupier Radio, along with my wonderful co-host, Divagechi Sierra Lupe.
Howdy doody, Rivera and Occupiers.
It has been a rather intense week out there in your neck of the woods, Sketch. Oof.
Yes, it has. Yes, it
Another
has.
Another shooting, this time at Umpqua Community College. You know, every time one of these happens, I sit down and I meditate and really send my heart out to the families of the victims of the shooting. It's horrible, you know, and it happens so frequently in our society. And I just feel like we're not really doing an adequate job of asking why. We talk about taking away the guns, but, you know, I'd love to see some comprehensive reports on these all too frequent mass shootings. Just saying, like, why do people choose to take this action?
You know, Rivera, our Congress actually is blocking pursuit of exactly what you're saying.
Do you know why?
I would assume it's because of the NRA and the gun lobby. But in July, Congress passed re-upped a ban on the CDC studying the roots of gun violence.
You know, that just seems like one more of their dereliction of duties and responsibilities to keeping the people safe, you know, while we're spending half of our budget on, you know, supposedly defense of the American people. Mm-hmm. That would be the military budget. You know, we won't, like, actually investigate a known cause of death. Something that I forget the statistics on it is just extravagantly more likely to be a cause of your own death than, say, terrorists, for example.
Mm. Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I did learn something interesting about guns and shootings. This comes from Stephen Schwartz and the Schwartz Reports. And some of our listeners will remember that he joined us on Occupy Radio a while back to talk about some of the trends going on around poverty. He also has a new book out, by the way, Eight Laws of Change, which I think we mentioned on that show. These are scientifically based strategies for enacting successful and enduring change in our lives and in the world. So it's been out since October 3rd, and I got to read a sneak preview, so I do recommend it. I do think it's a good book. But, you know, through his Schwartz Reports, which I follow, I did learn about the role of antidepressants and violence.
And mass shootings?
Well, the studies haven't looked directly at mass shootings alone. They look at all kinds of violence, and they find that, you know, certain drugs like Paxil and Prozac, not to name names, you know, you're 10.3 to 10.9 times more likely to do violence to yourself and others. And wow. That actually, a large percentage of the people who have done mass shootings were either on or recently were on antidepressants prior to the mass shootings. So, you know, there's one way of looking at this, which just says that, you know, they're mentally ill people, they're on antidepressants because they need them. There's another way of looking at it that says, well, wait a minute, let's just really think about this a little bit. What if these drugs are actually, as they're shown to do, causing the violence?
America is one of the most pharmaceutically drugged nations in the world, I would imagine. And that would link up pretty well with us being also the home of the largest number of mass shootings in the world.
I agree. So, you know, let's get on our Congress to get that study back done. I mean, maybe we'll find out. This is one for your Christmas conspiracy show, Getch. Uh-huh. Maybe we'll find out exactly what's blocking that study. And it might not be the NRA we suspected it is.
Well, we'll find out more. We'll look into that. But in the meantime, we've got a return guest. One of, well, I guess Forbes called Thomas Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, one of the top 10 revolutionaries in America. And we've got him on Occupy Radio for a return visit.
I have Thomas Lindsay in my presence, occupiers. And Thomas Lindsay is one of the co-founders of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. They go by CELDEF. And CELDEF assists communities in challenging corporate legal rights, which I think that's one of the things that the Occupy Wall Street movement was centered around. And Thomas, thank you for joining us here in Occupy Radio Studio West.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Thomas, it's been a while since we checked in with you. We did have you on Occupy Radio before in a lively interview that has been referenced over and over again by our listeners going back through the podcast archives. But, you know, we always have to start with the basics because we are growing. We do have new listeners. And before we dive into like what's new and brewing in the scene of community rights ordinances, perhaps we can start with just explaining to people what CELDEF is and what are these community rights ordinances and how do they work and why are they so important?
Sure. There's a lot wrapped up in that question. But just to start with, we started out as an environmental law firm, so a traditional conventional environmental law firm. And we did what environmental lawyers do, which is communities would be faced with things like toxic waste incinerators or fracking projects or large factory farms, any of the thousands of different single issue corporate projects that communities face every day. And they would come to us, and we were set up to provide free legal services to community groups working on conservation and environmental issues, mostly because accessing legal help today is a very expensive proposition for community groups. So you could be looking at $500 to $1,000 an hour just to hire a lawyer to look at a permit or answer questions about a certain corporate project. And so we were created to provide a need that we thought needed to be filled, which was that there aren't enough lawyers out there doing environmental protection work. And with the world falling apart, we thought that we should provide a couple more lawyers to do that work. And so for about a decade, we did what I would refer to as conventional environmental work, which was appealing permits and basically trying to delay projects that were coming into communities. And very quickly, we learned, not that quickly, actually, it took us 10 years to figure this stuff out. But eventually, we came to a point where we understood that the law itself is not structured to allow communities to say no to these corporate projects coming in. So if an incinerator is project is permitted by the state or federal government, that your community is legally prohibited from banning that particular project from coming in. And it's something that a lot of communities don't understand, and a lot of people just don't know about the structure of law because they figure, hey, we live in a democracy, and in a democracy you should be able to actually chart the course in the future of your community. But in the United States today, just the opposite is true, which is you don't have the authority to say no to these things coming into your community. And so back in the late 1990s, we began working with communities who decided to say no anyway. And I think it always sounds funny to say that, but the communities decided that instead of getting a factory farm, that they would rather actually begin to assert what has now become known as community rights, to say no to the project coming in, to say no to the corporation coming in, and to do something that I happen to find pretty extraordinary that these communities had the wherewithal to do, but not only say no to the project, but also go after the corporation itself and say, by what right do you as a corporation have greater rights than the people that live in this community to decide what this place is going to look like in the next 20, 40, or 60 years? And that has led to the last 10, 15 years of work, where close to 200 communities now in 10 states have actually decided to stand up and say there's something fundamentally wrong with the system of law and government that doesn't allow us to actually decide what our communities look like and that doesn't allow us to move towards economic and environmental sustainability. So I think that's the basic nutshell for what the community rights movement has become right now in the United States.
So, Thomas, I mentioned this to you before, and I think it's worthwhile, especially following your description of CELDEF. When I pulled Dr. Mary Wood aside at the ELAW conference here in Eugene a few months back, I brought your name up right away, and she pointed out that there's a distinction between what you and she do, and Occupy Radio listeners will remember Mary Wood coming on the show back in May to talk about court case, her judicial approach to the same issues that you're raising, Thomas. And I wonder if you could draw that distinction between your two approaches.
Sure. I mean, there's a bunch of different approaches out there. Ours tends to be that we've given up hope on any of the conventional governmental structures to assist communities to do what needs to be done. So the communities we work with have generally given up hope that state regulatory agencies, for example, are going to do anything to help them, or Congress, or their state legislature, that we're locked into what we refer to as the corporate state, that it doesn't really matter whether you're dealing with corporate officials or state officials anymore. They're the same people. And even if they're not physically the same people, that they're representing the same interests, because everything is dialed up to basically push everything towards endless production of more. In other words, that endlessly producing stuff, no matter what that stuff is, whether it's new incinerators or factory farms or natural gas being pulled from the ground, is all a good. And I guess we have less faith than folks like Professor Wood in the system actually functioning to deliver a remedy. So we don't trust judges to deliver a remedy to these communities. We hedge our bets, which is to say, when these communities that we work with who are saying no to these projects get sued and get hauled into court, we certainly hope that there are judges out there that will listen to our arguments and decide to go a different direction. But at the same time, we have to understand that the law in this country has been the law for 200 years, whether it's communities not being able to say no to corporate projects, whether it's state and federal governments controlling what municipal communities can or can't do, whether it's corporations as persons and other corporate rights. I mean, that stuff is so well ingrained in the constitutional structure of the United States that for us to see judges actually ruling against that stuff, it's very tough to see. And so we hope from time to time there are judges that do that, but we don't expect them to. And in fact, we think, you know, that even though some judges will pick this stuff up, and some judges already have through the litigation that we've done, that the only real change that's going to make any difference here is constitutional change, that these communities that have come together in different states like Oregon, for example, to give birth to statewide organizations who are now driving state constitutional change. And then you have to go eventually to the federal level, which we now have the National Community Rights Network, which is formed from these various state efforts, which is who have been approving a proposed federal constitutional amendment. So basically, you have to override the judges. If the judges aren't willing to recognize a right of local community self-governance, then you have to override them. The only way to do that is textually through changing these constitutional structures. So, you know, Professor Wood, Mary, is, you know, we're in agreement on one thing, which is the regulatory agency and the regulatory structures and the environmental regulations that are in place have been a miserable failure from at least our vantage point, which is that the world in this country is in worse shape now than 40 years ago when the major environmental laws were passed. And, you know, the hypocrisy, I think, is overwhelming. Just this past week, you know, a week and a half ago from when this show will air, you know, Shell Oil decided to pull out of Alaska from the drilling that they were doing. And they did it because they couldn't find any reserves. So it wasn't a good financial investment for them to make. But the next day, all of these large environmental organizations came out and said, "We won. It was a victory. You know, we pressured Shell into doing this or that, and give us more money to do the traditional environmental stuff." And it's just all crap. It's all garbage. It's, you know, it had nothing to do. In fact, it's actually a story of the failure of environmental law and environmental politics, that we had no way to stop the drilling rigs from getting to Alaska to actually begin the drilling. And so, you know, the system is so bad. It's not just the bad people like the corporations. I've begun to, you know, my personal opinion is that the large environmental groups are as big a problem as the corporations, because we look at them as allies, but in reality, they're not allies at all. They're sending us down the same tried and true environmental activism that's failed for the past 40 years. And at some point, we have to openly admit that. We have to openly say that. And like I said, there's a bunch of different approaches. Professor Wood hopes that the courts will be a savior of some kind. We don't think that's the case. And so we're trying to build and help build a community rights movement that isn't satisfied just with judicial rulings that go the other way or with the sorry state of affairs, but is actually attempting to take the system over. I mean, that's what it's about to us, at least.
Are we up against the environmental defense industrial military industrial complex? The environmental defense industrial complex?
It's almost like the nonprofit complex.
Industrial complex
operating out there, because everybody's always on the hunt for money, and these large environmental organizations just soak and sponge up hundreds of millions of dollars a year. I mean, our budget is a fraction of what most environmental organizations are, and you know, the community rights movement needs resources, and so you at some point it's hard to stay quiet about all these hundreds of millions of dollars that are running into the same old crap, you know, of appealing permits and testifying at hearings and writing letters to Congress. I mean, come on, you know, we all know that the system is so fixed that it needs to be broken. I mean, that's, you know, that's where we're at, which is you got to break the thing and then you got to rebuild it in a new way. And I think that's, you know, when I travel around and meet with community rights groups, that's what gets my blood going, is that people on the ground are beginning to understand in large numbers how this system treats them. And the system treats them not as citizens, not as people. It treats them as things, you know, like their own communities are treated as municipal corporations. So when the system looks at them, they see a municipal corporation run by a board of directors, which is their elected officials at the community level, and doesn't see the people in the community. It doesn't see the ecosystems in the community. Certainly doesn't see nature in the community. So we have a governmental system that is actually, like I said earlier, a corporate state. And if we think we can actually do anything within it at this point, we're the crazy ones, I think.
Well, I think there is one arena, and I'm glad you brought up the shell campaigns, because, you know, while there were the calls to action that were send petitions and call your senators, there were also on the ground direct action campaigns that happened. And everyone who knows me via our radio show knows that I'm a nonviolent action strategy junkie. And if you've heard some of my comments online, I have my own take on what could have been done better in the Shell No campaign and what was very successful in the Shell No campaign. But one thing we do know from nonviolent action is that the industry pays attention to wisely crafted strategies that we can incur direct costs to them, that can tip sometimes the risky endeavors that they're involved in. So that's a whole body of conversation for later. But how this relates to you, Thomas, is that the last time you were on Occupy Radio, you were talking about incorporating nonviolent action and civil disobedience clauses into the community rights so that where we might not have legal standing in the courts to support our community rights, they were incorporating clauses that allowed citizenry of a municipality to actually uphold and defend their community rights ordinance through nonviolent direct action. Have you continued that course of action since we last spoke, and has it been tested and tried, and what has been the results?
We have. It's actually become an integral part of our local lawmaking structure. It's actually part of our new templates for ordinances. And the way it works is that, you know, basically it says, you know, we pass this ordinance to ban a factory farm or fracking or whatever and strip corporate rights, and we're not going to recognize preemption when the state attempts to override our protective efforts here at the local level. And then it says, basically, after everything's been exhausted, you know, like a court comes in at the behest of the corporation to overturn the ordinance or it's nullified some other way, that direct action is then civil disobedience, and direct action is then legalized within the community. So in essence, it says that, you know, the local police can't be used to arrest folks who are directly enforcing the ordinance through civil disobedience and direct action. And, you know, the best word to use is that it legalizes it. It says this is an option now for people of the community to directly enforce this particular ordinance. It hasn't really been called into effect yet because, you know, as with most of this work, we're still at the beginning of some of it in most places. But for example, in eastern Pennsylvania, where they have a pipeline that's scheduled to move through the communities, people are talking about civil disobedience and the ordinance, you know, protections within those types of ordinances would be invoked to protect those folks from doing those actions. But I think it's important to understand that our strategy, you know, people sometimes say, oh, the community rights stuff, it's a dead end because all you're doing is passing laws and the courts are going to overturn them and it's not going to do any good in the end. Well, it's not a legal strategy. The community rights strategy is not a legal strategy. It's an organizing strategy, which is that it says, of course, there's the assumption that courts may come in and overturn the stuff or legislatures may act to nullify it. That assumption is built in from the beginning of the organizing. But the understanding is that you can't stop there. I mean, you're picking a fight. That's what these the local lawmaking is around the community rights stuff. You're picking a fight with some of the biggest, strongest, most powerful forces on the planet. And in picking the fight, you have to have a long-term plan. And you have to understand that the courts may not side with you, that the legislature may not side with you. Hell, you may not even find one elected official to side with you, which has happened in many places where the communities have outstripped their own elected officials locally. And so you have to understand that people are on their own. And in moving through this process, you know, the end game is structural change. And if structural change can't be obtained in the courts, then it means that we move to something else, which is, in many of these states, they have citizen initiative processes to amend their own state constitutions. And then eventually the state work has to propel itself up to the federal. But, you know, make no mistake about it, the community rights movement is about seizing our own governments and turning them upwards against this corporate and governmental beast that's been created. So it's almost like, you know, seizing our municipal governmental systems to turn them up like a torpedo into that corporate state that's formed. And eventually it's taking over the state. It's about taking over that state structure of law and eventually taking over the federal one. And I happen to think that because the situation here is so bad and everything is so DNA'd into our constitutional structure from the 1780s. I mean, you know, if you think about it, it's nuts. We have a 1780s archaic form of governance that was about exploiting natural resources as quickly as possible to build the United States as a major world power. And that constitutional structure has worked absolutely perfectly for that mission. But in terms of acidification of the oceans and deforestation and global warming and all the other stuff that we're faced with now, it's a 1780s archaic form of government. We need a sustainability constitution. And the only way that happens is that people stop taking no for an answer and begin building their own reality. And I think that's what the community rights movement is about.
When you're talking about different states building the structure until you can seize the state, it sounds like. And you also mentioned that there's a lot going on here in Oregon. Do those two intertwine?
Absolutely. In fact, just as an example, probably one of the better ones we have is New Hampshire, where in New Hampshire we had a dozen communities pass local laws against things like water bottling operations, power line projects. There's now some folks working on pipeline issues. But basically, communities that were working on those issues have now come together in the New Hampshire Community Rights Network, which is a state entity, state organization, which we now have in six different states. And that state organization has said, we got to keep doing these local laws because they're about picking the fights. And when you pick the fights, more and more people understand what the sides are. They understand that you got corporations and corporate rights and governmental power on one side, and on the other side you have the community itself. So you got to keep picking those fights and going through the courts and presenting arguments to judges. You got to do all that stuff. But you also got to understand that the end game here is about actually changing the constitutional structure. So now they've proposed a constitutional amendment, and that constitutional amendment would liberate communities to do the work that they're already doing. It would protect them and authorize them to do what they're already doing. Just last week, we picked up a Republican sponsor in the House of Representatives in New Hampshire. And it's not like we expect legislatures to embrace this, because it's about decentralizing power away from the legislators themselves. So we don't necessarily expect those things to move. But at the same time, it really validates the concept that even many state legislators want to see power held at the local level in this decentralized model. And in other states like Oregon and Colorado and Ohio, where they have citizens initiative, they have filed in two of those states already, filed constitutional amendments to put them on the ballot through a citizens initiative process. So it's all this giant chess game. It's about making a move, and then the other side makes a move, and then you make another move. And the end game is basically about, it's impossible to build sustainability in a system in which corporations wield rights and power as they do. And it's impossible to build sustainability when somebody 3,000 miles away from the communities that are impacted by these projects are actually making decisions about whether they come into the community or not. So, you know, it's a mess we're in. And to think we can get out of it by writing letters to Congress or, you know, testifying at permit hearings, I mean, I think that's crazy. I think that's insane.
How about signing online petitions? That's got to be what does it.
Yeah, signing online petitions. Yeah. Like we don't have, groups always fall back when they lose these battles and they say, well, we didn't have enough lawyers or we didn't have enough, flip charts or we didn't bring enough people out to the hearing. That's a rigged game. It's the microphones aren't even connected at most of the regulatory agency hearings. So what we have is a democracy theme park. It's got the trappings of a democracy, but it actually does not operate in any way whatsoever as a democratic system.
So I have a list of questions here for you, Thomas, but one of my questions has to do with, what is democracy? We live in this facade of democracy, but even just that word, I mean, it gives people who like to disempower other people the heebie-jeebies, and they are quick to talk about the tyranny of the majority without ever talking about the tyranny of the minority, which is currently the case. But what right now, our entire system is actually structured not as a democracy, but as a representative republic. In the community rights ordinance, are you trying to move more towards a participatory democracy versus a representative republic, or does it still maintain the structure of a representational system?
Well, we tend to bandy those terms around. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I went out and gave a talk, and I think it was a libertarian guy in the audience said, well, your whole premise is off because we weren't intended to be a democracy anyway. We're a republic, and therefore, nothing of what you're saying is really applicable here. To which I said, well, if we're a republic, then maybe we should need to become a democracy because maybe that's the underlying problem. But, we tend not to come at it from the 30,000 foot level of the academics or the abstract mm-hmm. stuff. It's more of people only care about this stuff if the system that they're living under is making the wrong decisions consistently. I mean, I happen to think that people don't have any vested interest really in democracy by itself as an abstract academic concept. They just want a system of government that works, that makes the right decisions, at least in their minds for the majority of the time. And I think we have a system that doesn't do that. And I think the only system that really does in the long run is a democratic system. It's less about participatory democracy. I think it's more in some ways about direct democracy, mm-hmm. returning to a direct democratic model at the local level. I mean, New Hampshire.
Maybe, Thomas, for our listeners, can you just distinguish between direct democracy and participatory democracy?
Participatory democracy is always, to me, like, having a seat at the table kind of thing. And, when somebody usually says, well, we need a seat at the table with decision making, I usually say, it's not that we need a seat at the table. We own the table. It's our table. We should be able to decide who sits at the table and who gets utensils and who gets an appetizer at the table. And so when we ask for a seat at the table, I always think that falls way short of where we actually need to be. So direct democracy is, people in a community coming together saying, we're going to define what agriculture should look like in our community. We're going to define what sustainable farming should look like within our community. And then actually have the tools to make that happen. And direct democracy, I think, perhaps best in the states where we work is exemplified in New Hampshire and the New England states where they have town meeting. So at town meeting day each year, you can put something on the docket of the town meeting. It's called a warrant article. And then people come in and they actually vote on it. They actually vote on whether to make it law or not. And we've had about a little over a dozen laws in Maine and New Hampshire passed that way. But I think we have people so disconnected from the political process at this point that we need to inject a direct element into it so that people don't say, oh, yeah, we have a democracy. I vote. Well, voting is not the thing. Voting is one piece of it. But actually being direct democratic decision makers and policy makers, that's something that people need to have that role. And so, I roll my eyes whenever somebody says, well, you got to exercise your right to vote because that's a democracy. Well, voting is part of it, but the bigger part of it is actually creating the world that we want and having the legal authority to do it. So I think that's what we need.
And when it comes right down to it, there is no real point in voting when you think about it because of the fact that we don't actually get people to vote for anymore.
Well, plus you get, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are corporations in
exactly,
many ways.
Yeah.
And whoever they produce is, you're told you got to vote no matter who they are. And even if you had no say in who they actually were, and you got a litmus test of who can actually get into office and, all that stuff. So I'm to a point where I'm this is controversial, but I kind of urge people not to vote anymore, because when you vote, you're legitimating the system. By showing up, you're legitimating the stuff that you that we shouldn't be. And so, you know, I'm almost to that point where I've given up on that kind of participation as being a good thing, because I think it just validates the system. And then people stand back and say, hey, we had 60% voter turnout, as if that's some kind of validation of the entire political electoral system. So I think I'm all about withdrawing at this point. Let's build what we know needs to be built, and let's stop screwing around with the stuff that is a waste of time.
And we'll come back and talk more with Thomas Lindsay after we take a quick break for a station ID. But also, we want to bring up some other news that's happening right now all across the country. Over the past weekend in Atlanta, negotiators came to agreement about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, while the corporate Americans are probably going, woo, hooray,
shipping,
the rest
popping.
Of us. Exactly, are having some shudders go down our spine. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is an issue we've covered on Occupy Radio. It's a terrible deal for the people, a great deal for the corporations.
Yes, yes. And I am wondering, Rivera, as we enter this conversation, and I agree, everything I've seen about this secret document, so we're actually entering the phase where we're going to really find out what's in the document. But the genesis of the corporate state has been always moving away from the nation state. And as we become a international economy, it seems to me that the TPP or something like it is eventually going to happen. And maybe we can somehow dodge this particular bullet, because it's a horrible, horrible plan. But eventually, that's the direction we're going in.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the take-home message here is, like, until we have real democracy and, you know, the majority or all of the nations involved in negotiating these trade deals, and we the people are negotiating them, we have good cause and reason to be extremely suspicious and not very favorable towards deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TTIP agreement, and the TISA agreement, which are also coming our way. You know, and until that time where, you know, our global community, i.e. we, the 7.2 billion people, actually are involved in making the trade deals that actually support and enhance life on Earth versus corporate profits, I think we all need to be taking some action. You know, there is a mass mobilization coming up November 14th through 18th in D.C. to stop the TPP. There's a lot of information about that at flushthetpp.org. So, you know, I think this is the kind of direct nonviolent action that people need to be taking if we want to not be subjects and peons of a corporate state, but actually have some form of
autonomy.
Autonomy would be great. Sovereignty would be great. Uh-huh. You know, decision-making power about the things that actually affect our lives, things like poverty, the environment, our ability to do trade. You know, it's not just like total radical leftists who are against this deal. I mean, a lot of libertarians and a lot of conservatives also dislike this deal, mainly because it's what they call crony capitalism at its worst. You know, this is not just a deal for corporations. This is a deal for the mega corporations.
Oh yeah, small business doesn't benefit from this.
Right. It may be good for Wall Street, but it's not good for Main Street and the old illusion that's rapidly dismantling right now of what's good for business is good for us is really going to show its ugly head with these deals. We're going to see very rapidly that, you know, the profits of the major transnational corporations do not equate to better standings of living for anyone on the planet.
Just look at America today. Biggest corporate profits in history. Biggest wealth divide, highest poverty rates, et cetera, et cetera. And Thomas Lindsay, our guest today, gets involved in that a little bit, but really mostly we're going to be talking about how to empower communities for the rest of the show. And I say, let's head into it.
You're listening to Occupy Radio from KWVA.
This is Occupy Radio on KBOO
the
Portland.
Pacifica Radio Network.
Again,
streaming
Occupy
at
Radio, interviewing
org,
Thomas Lindsay,
and podcasting at OccupyRadio.org.
About the community rights movement.
.org.
We'll go back to the show.
Now, Thomas, I want to check in with a couple of the community rights projects that have had some major kind of adventures this year. For instance, Mendocino passed a community rights ordinance. Mora County had theirs struck down in state or federal court. Perhaps you can update us about that one. And then let's talk a little bit about Denton, Texas, and what the Texas legislature did, overturning 150 years of home rule law to try to strike down the community rights ordinance in Denton. Can we give an update on those three?
Sure. So big news in California, which was the first county adopted a rights-based ordinance in Mendocino. So that was a big deal. First place in California to do so. In Mora County, New Mexico, it's more of a mixed bag. And the mixed bag occurred because, you know, just to go back a little bit in time, it was the first county in the United States to pass a law banning hydrocarbon extraction within the municipality. And immediately after passing it, and we had a 2-1 majority to pass it, so we had two very outspoken county commissioners who really drove the law into place. So at the time it was passed and at the time the lawsuits were filed, we had that 2-1 majority, and we had one dissenting person who was very strong in her dissent about not wanting the ordinance in place. And so the lawsuits moved on. The county selected us as legal counsel, among other lawyers, to defend the case. We defended the case, and then an election intervened in the middle. So we were litigating the case. Election in the middle replaced that 2-1 majority with a 1-2 minority. So only one advocate for the ordinance. The other two decided to fold. And so they pulled the carpet out from underneath the litigation by opening up negotiations with the oil and gas corporations that had originally sued the county. And unceremoniously fired us from the case. So we no longer had any input in how the case transpired. So you had a political change in Mora County that resulted in a strategic change. And that strategic change, at least in my mind, was an absolute mistake. Because when you get in that position, you lose the ability to even appeal the bad decision that came down from the district court, from the federal court in that case. So it was bad news. But it's also the cost of doing business in this area, which is the oil and gas company wanted to replace the one commissioner and get a 2-1 majority for their own means within Mora County. And that's what happened. And so that's how Mora County transpired. What was the third one you wanted an update on?
Denton, Texas.
Oh, Denton. Yeah, Denton's really not one of our communities. Denton passed a ban on fracking within their city limits immediately after. I think it was 24 hours after they passed the law. They were sued twice, one by a public entity, I think the Lands Commission or a public agency, and the other one was a private lawsuit. And then they, you know, as this stuff works, then I think it was only 2 or 3 months afterwards that the legislature convened and wrote a better preemptive law to specifically ban places like Denton from banning fracking within their municipal limits.
The fracking ban banned.
The fracking ban.
Yeah. You know, and those aren't actually that uncommon. We did have to fight that back in New Mexico, which, you know, New Mexico is one of the most fracked states, and nobody in New Mexico really understands that, which is crazy. I mean, we have a methane plume over the Four Corners region that's visible from space because of the fracking. But, you know, so we're familiar with this preemption legislature. I mean, the ban mm-hmm. situation. So that was interesting. But in Texas, it was particularly interesting because they already have a history of home rule, and it's a very vibrant history. And so, in a way, the Texas legislature had to fly in the face of that to actually pass this ban on the bans.
Well, I don't think that's quite true. You know, a lot of places have long home rule histories, like Pennsylvania and Colorado, for example, has this. terrific home rule provision in the Colorado Constitution, which says that communities can pass laws dealing with local issues and can even supersede state laws if they deal with local issues in that way. The problem is that most of that home rule authority has been very carefully circumscribed so that it only deals with issues of local concern. So if the community begins to step outside of that, they get hammered. So sometimes there's less to the eye than actually on paper. And so in Colorado, the way it's been used is that you had the town of city of Greeley 20 years ago pass a frack ban and went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, well, fracking, you would think, might be a local issue, but it really isn't, because the oil and gas reserves transcend municipal boundaries. And because of that, when the city decides to ban fracking, or not fracking, but oil and gas withdrawal within the city, you're actually impacting oil and gas reserves that are outside the municipal boundaries. So it's not really local, and therefore home rule authority doesn't apply. And so there's all kinds of ways around the home rule stuff. You would think in Texas, just the general political stance of, you know, keep your hands off Texas and this is my community and don't screw with me kind of thing would have come into play. But that stuff only comes into play when it's protective of certain property rights and not others. And so Denton got hammered pretty good. And in fact, we had talked with people in Denton about the need to go beyond their ban and actually go after corporate rights and preemption frontally, but they weren't ready to do that, and we predicted that this would happen, and that's what happens when you don't go after the structure.
So I want to jump back just a little bit. In the Grants Township, I read a thing by, I don't know, Natural Gas News or whatever, Natural Gas Now, where they called you the potty mouth lawyer with a conflict of interest, which in, you know, the potty mouth lawyer was great, but the conflict of interest, and then you said that in Mora County, they named you as one of the legal counsel, and I assume the same thing was happening in Grants Township as well?
Well, Grant Township is a little different situation. Grant was it's a small community in Pennsylvania who's fighting off a frack injection wastewater well.
Which they termed as perfectly non-controversial.
Right. Tell that to the people in Grant Township. I guess being called a potty mouth lawyer, that's just like being called a lawyer, right? Because most of the lawyers I meet are pretty potty mouth, but I do swear a lot, and I think it's time for that. I guess sometimes to make a point, you have to.
It shakes people up.
It shakes people up, and the deal is the times that we're in. I think if we can't swear now, I'm not sure when we would be able to. You know, sometimes the times call for it. But I will say on that line is that, whereas a lot of the liberal progressive community across the United States is wringing their hands over the community rights stuff, like, oh, my God, we can't allow the communities to actually have control over whether frack wells come in or not. And so we get that a bunch, is that the oil and gas companies, they know what a threat this is. And in fact, there was a quote from them last year in the Mora County litigation where they said, this is the beginning of a social movement that could change all kinds of things for corporations in the United States.
Hear, hear.
They get it. And in fact, they're attacking us now every day, which to me at least shows that we're closing in on the bullseye, the target, so to speak. But the corporate boys, they understand exactly what this work is. They understand it's about building a movement that's eventually going to change the landscape of how they operate. But it's always been strange to me that you got the liberal, conventional liberals and progressives wringing their hands off on the sideline when the corporations understand exactly what's happening.
And you guys are at the third state that Gandhi puts, you know, first they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win, or
I think we're in the second stage right now, fighting us, but
You've got ignoring you in there. Okay, so you're at the third stage. Yeah. They're fighting you.
I did ignore
you for a while, as long as they thought they could get away with that. But I think, you know, that recent quote was fairly accurate. You are heading into the bullseye on them, which is, in my opinion, great. You know, I wanted to ask you a kind of a tricky question, but a very timely and important question, since in where Getch is at, and you're at right now, in Eugene, Oregon, over in another part of Oregon, they recently had a shooting. Mm. And, you know, many people have been calling for tighter gun regulations or even an overturning of the Second Amendment for guns. And it's a hugely controversial issue all throughout the United States. People are very divided on it. Could a community rights ordinance be used to for in a community that feels strongly that there should be tighter gun regulations to pass those tighter gun regulations for their community, even if, you know, on the state or federal level, there's political inaction on that?
Sure. And in fact, the state and federal political levels have been marked by inaction over the past, you know, 30 years in that department. You know, the National Rifle Association and all those big political lobbies have basically frozen any kind of gun control legislation at those levels. I think the answer to your question is yes. If a community wanted to move in that direction and make it a rights-based public safety issue, I think they'd be perfectly able to use to extend some of this work to do that. I'll also mention that, you know, people think about the community rights stuff as environmental only, and of course I come out of environmental law background, so a lot of times I talk about that. But, you know, in Spokane, Washington, there's now a worker bill of rights that's moving and is on the ballot this year. It would require a family wage be paid to employees of large corporations, operate large employers within the city of Spokane, would guarantee equal pay for equal work, would get rid of at-will dismissals, firings within the city of Spokane. And in addition to that, you know, we've worked on a number of other issues like municipal foreclosures, you know, private foreclosures within municipalities over mortgages and housing. You know, there's the $15 an hour folks, minimum wage folks are now working with our folks in Colorado to move the constitutional amendment forward because they understand that state law preempts municipalities from setting different minimum wage or higher minimum wages. So I think the door is really wide open for that kind of work. It's not just environmental. It's also social justice, civil rights, those types of things.
I noticed one of your articles, Thomas, that I read just before this was in Deep Green Resistance. And they have a very clear stand that just regulating carbon and just recycling and whatnot doesn't do anything. And I guess there's a nascent de-development movement starting to grow. Are you at all familiar with that?
I'm not. No.
Yeah. How do you feel about the concept, though? Where I guess the idea being, it won't do us any good to try to maintain our lifestyle and just greenify it.
Right.
That we are beyond what is good for our world.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of that resonates with me, and Derek Jensen's work resonates uh-huh. with me. You know, when he talks about the last time we were living sustainably on the planet was the Bronze Age or something like that. I think he's probably right about all that stuff. How do we get back to that without some kind of, you know, collapse, which I think inevitably the collapse is coming? I don't know the answers to most of that, except to know that the system right now is insane and it runs on insanity. And I think turning to people and people's understanding of where we sit is one of the things that has to happen. I will say this, you know, the global warming stuff, absolutely one of the biggest issues of our time. You know, Pope Francis recently yeah. came through and I almost fell off the chair, but Pope Francis actually used the phrase rights of nature in one of his
yeah.
talks. And so, like I said, I almost fell out of the chair on that one. But, you know, we talk about global warming and climate change and CO2 in the atmosphere, but we don't really have global – we have global warming, of course, but we also have global poisoning, which seems to be mm-hmm. lost in the conversation, that we pour billions of tons of stuff into the atmosphere each year. So it's not just CO2 that's a problem. We're poisoning the planet. It's not just a warming issue. It's actually the you know, the cumulative effect of our presence on the planet in refusing to treat it as a closed system. CO2 is just the first thing to come down the line, but there's, you know, benzene and all this other stuff that's now in the atmosphere and all the stuff that we're putting out. So I think it's a much bigger problem than just warming issues and just CO2. And I think we need to begin to reframe all that, because if we don't, then we concentrate down on one chemical constituent or one compound, and we don't actually understand that it's our collective impact that we're having on the planet that's the problem.
You've got West Virginia, where they can't use most of their watersheds, you know? Right.
Yeah, you have West Virginia where they blow the tops off of mountains. Mm-hmm. And talk mm-hmm. about the failure of conventional environmental law. You know, Robert Kennedy made this film last year called The Last Mountain. Well, I don't want to be making films about the last mountain, you know, you're trying to save the last one. I want something that's going to save all of them. And instead, we get into these situations where right now, almost all of the mountains that are that have minerals that the coal companies covet have been blown off. You go into West Virginia, you see them, they're leveled. The ecosystems are completely destroyed. And environmental law has done nothing, absolutely nothing to stop any of that from happening. And if that's not a complete, you know, condemnation of current environmental law, I don't know what it is.
And you have the gas companies coming in and talking about perfectly non-controversial injection wells.
Yes, and to them it is non-controversial. They need a place to put their waste. And they put, I mean, one of the developments, one of the updates is that in this little place, Grant Township, I think they have 600 people, they've now stood up against one of the largest oil and gas companies in Pennsylvania to say no frack wastewater injection well here. So the frack water, the dirty frack water comes off the frack wells. They have to have a place to put it. They inject it into the ground. They're trying to do that in Grant Township. And the Grant folks said, we're not going to let you. So they passed not only passed the law and got sued for it, which has now been a year in transit in the federal courts. But to our amazement, two things have happened. Number one, the state agency, the state environmental agency, has said we're suspending our consideration of a permit for the site because of the ordinance. So it's the first time in the United States where a state agency has said, because of a rights-based ordinance, we're going to suspend our consideration of a permit to be issued. Because up until now, the state agencies have just ignored these community rights ordinances. But this is the first time a state agency has said, we're going to make a decision based on that community rights ordinance in place. So that kind of was amazing. And the second thing is, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, just Tim DeChristopher, I read a recent quote from him that said that the era of unprotested fossil fuel development is over. And I thought that was so key and pertinent for people to really cognate on, to really understand that we are in a new era with fossil fuels. We're in a new era with our energy sources, and we must be. If we're not, we're going to die of extinction. There's not really any other option. We need to reframe what's going on and understand that our actions now, even if, like with you, Thomas, I know that this has been such a long haul, such a long journey with so much critique going on and advancements and successes, but also setbacks. But to know at every step of the way that you are part of the web of resistance that is actually tightening the noose on these old behaviors. And it's so hard to see until the whole web starts to tighten together. And that takes time and a great deal of faith. I mean, I'd love to ask you about where you get your perseverance and your faith.
Yeah, I mean, the place I get it is from the communities who are actually beginning to stand up. I mean, in some ways, I think you're right about the web closing. I think there's a tremendous amount of work that has to be done over the next 20 years to make all of that real. But the fact is that in some ways we play a very small part in everything, which is we provide information. We help people understand what they're going through, the trauma of what they're going through, and we assist them to do something that has the promise of pulling not just them out of it, but everybody out of it who is in a similar situation. And so, you know, my batteries get charged when I come out. You know, last week I did an Oregon tour of eight different cities and come out and actually meet people on the ground who are beginning to do this work, who have had similar experiences to ours, and who validate this course of work. And so I think it's less about faith. I think in some ways it's about end of the world stuff. I mean, we're so close now to seeing how that happens because of the myriad of problems that we're facing today, that I think it's much easier to do the work now in some ways because more and more people are beginning to understand that this is the end game. I mean, these are the last pieces. Either we make the change now or we're done. And when it's that stark and there aren't a lot of options available, I think more and more people begin to turn to this kind of cutting edge stuff.
I think our politics are also just getting to that stark point, and everything's coming together, it seems like, to the point where we all understand that we're going to have to take some kind of action. And you're leading people in taking that kind of action. And we're talking with Thomas Lindsay, one of the co-founders of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And I think I read today that I don't remember which authority it was, listed you as one of the top 10 revolutionaries in America today.
Yeah, and I was not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because it came from Forbes magazine a number of years ago.
But, so yeah, it could have been an epithet.
It could have been either, yeah. I don't know.
Well, I want to give you a chance, Thomas. We've got about a minute left. Anything you want to get out to our listeners, any way they can find you on the internet? We also have an event coming up next week, I think. I think it'll happen the same day this show comes out, the 7th, right? Yeah. So let our listeners know what's going on.
Yeah. We're always, communities that run up against these corporate projects, we're here to help. And we're on the web at celdef.org. That's CELD as in David, F as in Frank.org. It stands for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And our main office, area code 717-498-0054. And again, we have about 200 communities across the United States who have begun moving and have passed these kinds of new community rights laws, and various stages of stuff happening in each of them. But we're available to do democracy schools, which are these two-day trainings that we do for lawyers and municipal officials and the general public, as well as to help design local laws that the communities can help draft as they move through the process and then into adoption. And then, of course, litigation defense over those laws once they're passed. But get in contact with us. We have publications. Just had a new book come out called On Civil Disobedience and Sustainability, the Community Rights Movement in the United States. And that's available through us or through PM Press. But it covers a lot of the background of the community rights movement. So give us a call or find us on the web.
And I want to thank you for joining us on Occupy Radio. I have attended one of your democracy schools, and I just feel like it's essential for every community. I think any community should be holding them annually to really understand what we are as a nation and what we could be as a nation, both in the good sense and the bad sense. So thank you for joining us on Occupy Radio and exploring these themes with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us back on.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Up next is Hard Knock. And here's a little info that we tailored just for you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of La Peña Flamenca de Portland, Saturday, November 21st at 8 p.m. at the Headwaters Theater in Portland. This month, the band will be El Cuadro Pepe y Rafael y Lily Last with cantores Elisa Rocha y Christy Jenny. Again, that's La Peña Flamenca de Portland, Saturday, November 21st at 8 p.m. at the Headwaters Theater, located at 55 Northeast Farragut Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for two positions. We are hiring a membership director. This is a part-time position, 32 hours per week, $15.11 per hour. We're also hiring a PM News and Public Affairs director. This is a salary full-time position,